If I may proceed?
Very well.
May it please the court. In focusing first on the issue of whether the jury instruction below on informed consent properly focused on causation as the end result with the way it was given, as opposed to the discussion between the physician and the patient, which the defense contends is the proper place to put it, I'd like to talk about a case, a real case, which I was assigned after the briefing was done. Mr. Lenkink has a copy of the complaint. It's not an informed consent case, but it may be one. It illustrates just why the jury instruction by Judge Babiarz in Bello is better.
Is this in the record?
No.
So you're
I suppose it's a hypothetical.
Very well. We'll assume it's a hypothetical.
Sir?
We'll assume it's a hypothetical.
In this hypothetical case, the patient is admitted to a hospital for a torn esophagus. A surgical procedure is done, and the patient wakes up blind. This blindness is a result of a complication that occurs about one in every 100,000 at a maximum. It's very, very rare. In this hypothetical situation, there is an informed consent paperwork, so there was a discussion. In this hypothetical situation, the allegation is not informed consent. It's surgery was done too quickly. But it could be an informed consent case because, hypothetically, it's unlikely that blindness was ever mentioned as a potential risk for this surgery because this particular surgeon had not seen it in 30 years of his experience, though it's known to exist. I would doubt in that hypothetical situation the plaintiff could get an expert who said it's customarily given, and the defense could rely on that portion of the statute to counter that argument. But no one could guarantee that could happen. On the other hand, in that case, the best defense would be, given the fact that a ruptured esophagus must be repaired, it can't have conservative treatment, there must be surgical intervention. The best defense would be, even if blindness had been mentioned as a potential risk in addition to infection and death, the patient would have still gone ahead with the procedure because it's highly likely the procedure, quote, caused, close quote, the blindness. Under the jury instruction given in this case, the defense, if there was an informed consent claim, would be able to argue not customarily given, not the type of thing a patient would want. But the best defense available would be to say it wouldn't matter, given the seriousness of this situation, which is not an emergency. The patient would still consent, or the patient's family would still consent to this procedure. They would have had it anyway, regardless of what was said to them. That particular defense is not available if the dependent of causation in jury instruction below is affirmed, because the below instruction focuses on the end result, whether the procedure caused the injury, as opposed to the actual discussion between the patient and the physician, where it should be focused. In fact,
and is this the part of the brief where we had the debate about invited error and you cited Culver versus Bennett, or is this
a different instruction? Different instruction, okay. Because we, in our pre-trial paperwork, we posited this particular aspect of it, and Judge Scott respectfully declined to give us that instruction.
So this was an instruction that wasn't given. The other argument in the brief is about the instruction that was given.
The instruction that I'm talking about, the instruction I am arguing that the Bello instruction, which Judge Babiarz gave, is proper, and the Koch instruction, which was given here, is improper on the focus of causation. Judge Scott specifically and correctly said that informed consent is not a battery. He was absolutely right when he said that. But the instruction that followed was the one that we take issue with, and the court will look at the paperwork. The particular instruction that we submitted pre-trial, which is...
I remember that.
So this one was properly raised all along.
I just wasn't completely oriented when you started off with the hypothetical,
okay,
about which instruction we were talking about.
Okay. My apologies, Your Honor. The focus was on the causation aspect and what I call the Bello versus Koch aspect of the case. And we believe, and the defense asserts, that that is where the focus should be. It must be on the patient's discussion with the physician. Now, that has a spin-off effect and brings within it the other major argument the court has to focus on, and whether or not informed consent is proper and is part of the colloquy with prescription medicine.
Let me ask you one more question just to see if I'm oriented on where we're going with your argument that you've presented so far. I would assume the thrust of it is that this particular patient's condition was so serious, even though she was on dialysis, she would have taken this medication anyway.
Correct. Our position is, and when you deal with that, you can't divorce. This necessarily gets to the next argument about prescription medication, if I may explain the two together. You can't divorce from the fact that, first of all, Dr. Lewis did say he wouldn't leave the patient in the dark. So contrary to the assertion he never told her anything, we disagree. But the fact remains, our position is that had everything been told to Mrs. Koch in the way the plaintiff suggests should have been told to her, her answer would have been, Dr. Lewis, I trust your judgment. I will go ahead with it anyway, which is the analogy to what Judge Babiar said in a products liability failure to warn case. If the warning is given, they still go ahead and do it. And that's the thrust of that argument. Does that answer Your Honor's question?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. If I may move on to the prescription medicine part of it, not because of A, time, and B, I think they're interwoven. The issue on prescription medicine is not really whether or not informed consent should be given in prescription medicine cases. That's the narrow issue. That's how it arose below. But really, the focus and the result will be the concept and the definition of what is treatment on the informed consent statute. And this particular case and the issue on that aspect is unusual for the court because unlike cases where you are deciding pure statute of limitations situations, Ewing versus Beck, the Meyer case that I argued about a month ago before this court, in this particular case, depending on the result, in a way, and I say this most respectfully, the court will be telling doctors a bit how they have to practice medicine. Because if you're going to put prescription medications under the rubric of informed consent, because of the complications that arise, then you really have to include over-the-counter medications, which are often quote-unquote prescribed.
So your argument is prescribing medicine is not a form of treatment.
Our argument is that it goes too far, yes. That treatment, let me tell you how this case where informed consent would work perfectly.
All right, but before you give me your explanation, tell me if I'm correct, that your argument is prescribing medicine does not constitute treatment.
Yes.
Okay.
And here, if I may continue, it's in the fact, for example, it's not so much a definitional thing, because you could easily say it is. There's a result-oriented portion of this. There's an aspect of this which is result-oriented. Let me tell you how it fit in this case. It's a yes or no, Your Honor. When Mrs. Koch came into the hospital and Dr. Lewis treated her and she had her atrial fibrillation, he had a choice of saying, I can do nothing. Sometimes they convert on their own. I can try and convert you from atrial fibrillation to normal sinus rhythm medically by medication, or I can simply shock you right now. And those were the three treatment areas. And if you want to talk about informed consent, it wasn't done in this case. We don't know if that discussion was taken. You may assume for the appeal it really wasn't. But you can have a discussion. Mrs. Koch, there's a number of ways to proceed. There are risks to doing nothing, and these are them. There are risks to doing a electrical shock right now, and these are them and benefits. There's a risk. We can try you medically, and these are the risks there. And in a generic sense, you can compare the two, and the patient can say, look, doctor, I think, And here's my recommendation. And even their expert, Reifel, admitted, I can cite the page, that a doctor's recommendation has to be with this. My concern when you look at this entire causation overlap prescription medicine treatment definition is the removal of the process from the doctor's recommendation. Herein lies the rub, so to speak. And that's where we're focused on. There's a lot of practical aspects of it. The amicus brief touched on that. Also, you can, in this particular case, as a practical matter, if Dr. Lewis is told, you have to give an informed consent talk on Sotalol. And by the way, he said he wouldn't leave in the dark, so he might have. But for appeal purposes, we'll assume it wasn't there. He also has to give the informed consent talk on all the on the alternate drug. One thing that's not been focused on here is the other drug, amiodarone, is not without risk. And he would be saying such things as, Mrs. Koch, if we take this logical conclusion, I can give you this drug. And by the way, there's some people who, there's some books that say I really shouldn't give it in dialysis patients. Although I can tell you that the CCS formula says you can, and the record will show their pharmacologist didn't have a problem with it. Or I can give you another drug. And that drug says, if I'm wrong, and that drug has side effects that last for months, and I can't withdraw them quickly. And she's inevitably going to say, what do you want me to do? What do you think I should do? And he's inevitably going to say, I think you should do this. And they're really intertwined. And if you are going to uphold the treatment aspect of the case and say that virtually everything is a matter of informed consent, then that is even more imperative that the causation aspect not be put to the very end of the case, where Judge Scott has it respectfully, but be put on the informed, on the discussion part of the case where it belongs. Because if you don't, the two together as it stands has taken a situation where a doctor prescribing any medication is basically becomes almost an insurer of its result if it doesn't work out. The only defense being it's not the type of thing doctors customarily say, and then you get into a battle of the experts, which is always a precarious place, and it's better to have a more common sense approach, which is the approach Judge Babbier says. Yes, Your Honor.
I'm having trouble following your argument, which I'm sure is my problem here, but you're describing a hypothetical situation where the doctor would say you've got three different more conventional treatment options of surgery or other possibilities, and you've got a medication option, and now I'm going to tell you about the different medicines that I could give you, and this one has possible side effects here, and this one has possible side effects there. And then you seem to be arguing that somehow if the doctor were required to do that, that would offend some notion of the way medicine is carried out. I mean, I'm not really understanding what's the problem with that.
The problem might be so much as there's two problems. One is if the court overrules, agrees that the prescription medicines should be part of the informed consent statute, that, in my opinion, is even more the reason to overturn the jury instruction given, because I believe it would transform informed consent, at least as to medicines, into strict liability. But going into the...
Well, but see that, all right, explain that.
Very simple, because right now, as the way it works is, the causation prong has nothing to do with the discussion. It's simply, I prescribe a medicine, and that medicine caused an injury, and it is irrelevant under the present jury instruction in Koch whether the patient would have agreed to it regardless of what they were told. I suppose that's the analogy of the failure to warn. Right now, the way I believe it, and the defense contends in the Bella one, was the argument was she shouldn't, in that case, that she wouldn't have, should, there should not have been a surgery in the first place. That they should have done the cancer treatment conservatively. And there was a lot of issues back and forth. The plaintiff's family said she would not have consented to this. We know her well. We presented evidence that suggested otherwise. And we were allowed to argue that even if she had been told of X, Y, Z, which was dispute, she would have still gone ahead with the surgery because no matter what, she wanted to know whether she really had cancer or didn't have cancer. In that case, there was no doubt that the surgical procedure to try and take a piece from her lung and biopsy her caused her death because there was an inadvertent striking of the nerve, of a vein during the procedure.
Well, let's come back to this case. As I understood what you said earlier, in this case you said the doctor, if he would have had a discussion, would have said, I can give you another medicine with long-term side effects. I can give you this medicine, which not everybody agrees is good for people on dialysis. or I can shock you immediately. Your argument seems to be she would have obviously picked the medicine he prescribed.
The argument that I'm making is there's the treatment definition should be on, basically, for lack of a better term, which tree do I climb, as opposed to how do I climb that tree? Because there comes a point in time that you have to permit the doctor to exercise his skill, his training, to come in and say, look, this is a tricky situation. There are these three different areas, and I will. And if you want this one as opposed to that one, shock right away as opposed to medicine, I can live with that. Frankly, I'm not too sure it's the right way to do it, but I can live with that. And we're not saying she's divorced of any informed consent option. We're simply saying that this is a point where this is a good line drawing. You look at the basic treatment parameters. This is the treatment concept, surgery, no surgery, medicine, no medicine. But once you get to this medicine opposed to that medicine, I mean, the court, I'm sure, has seen a PDR with a thousand and thousands of pages of things that it would mean. The practical aspects of it are pretty frightening.
Mr. Elsafan,
yes, Your Honor.
Going back briefly to your causation argument, even under the instruction that was actually given by the trial judge, your side would have been free to argue that there was no causation here as a result of, you know, there being an uninformed consent, because under the facts of this case, Ms. Koch would have consented anyway. You were free to argue that. Is that correct?
Yes, but I was not free to argue that. I was not free to argue to the jury that your instructions, if the jury.
Okay, I'm getting to that. I gather you have a two-pronged claim here, and tell me if I have it right or not. First, that the causation test, the substantive test, should be that the patient would have consented even if complete full disclosure had been made.
Yes.
And secondly, that the jury, and the jury has to be so instructed.
Yes.
And moreover, the burden of proving that rests with the plaintiff.
Yes.
Now, are any of are the burden of proof and the substantive law point all holdings that we would have to determine as a matter of first impression here? That is any of that the law now?
I believe the Bellow case, that's the way it was done in the Bellow case. I can't off the top of my head think of any Supreme Court case where you have directly confronted that and said this is the way we're going to do it. Because with all due respect to Judge Scott, who's a really good judge, and I'm not being patronizing here, this is the first time I think it's come up in this context.
Do you want to save your
I really do. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon.
May it please the Court, Justice Hahn, Justice Berger, Justice Jacobs, Tim Lankick on behalf of the appellee plaintiffs below. With regard to the informed consent claim, it's our position that the General Assembly did not carve out medication orders from the informed consent statute. Number two, that there is a causation prong within the informed consent statute as it currently exists. And number three, that the jury instruction, which was not complained of below, is not clearly erroneous in light of the facts of this case. Before I go to those three points, though, I want to start with this. Even if the court should conclude that there was error below, the case should be affirmed because the record, taken as a whole, supports the jury's verdict in this case, which included medical negligence claims against both defendants and the subset claim for informed consent. The informed consent claim is a subordinate or alternative claim to the underlying medical negligence claim.
Before you get
claim.
To that, were there any special interrogatories in this case, or did the jury return a general verdict?
A general verdict, Your Honor. The underlying medical negligence claim was not hotly contested in terms of liability. The defense was a causation defense. The defense did not call a standard of care expert at trial. The only retained standard of care expert that the jury heard from was Dr. Rafel, whom the plaintiffs called below. Now, the case was certainly defended on causation, and the defense had two experts, and the plaintiffs had two experts. The informed consent claim, though, was a fairly minor part of the trial. It was mentioned in opening, it was mentioned in closing, but I went back and counted, and of 93 pages of my expert's testimony, he mentioned informed consent on 3 pages. The point of this is that when the record's taken as a whole, there was plenty of evidence to support the jury's finding on the underlying medical negligence case.
When you say that the defense was no causation, do you mean that, and I'm talking now about the substantive claim, not the informed defense claim, that the administration of this particular medication didn't cause the fatality?
That's correct, Your Honor. Judge Bailick has a case called Coker, which we cite in our papers, and in that case, the same issue arose. There was an informed consent claim and a dental negligence claim, and the defense complained about some of the proof that the plaintiff had put forth to support the informed consent claim, and Judge Bailick said, okay, I agree, but there was still enough evidence below to support the jury's finding on the underlying claim. And I would submit that that is exactly what is in this case. And borrowing from the criminal context, if you look at the entire record of this case, the informed consent claim was such a very small portion of this case that the jury's verdict should be affirmed. Moving on to the informed consent claim itself, as I said, the informed consent statute does not exempt medications from treatment. And, in fact, the General Assembly used the words treatment, procedure, or surgery. And certainly by those three words, we know the General Assembly did not limit informed consent claims to surgery or invasive procedure. They wouldn't have used treatment, procedure, or surgery if that's in fact what they meant.
Just as an aside, I don't want to take up a lot of time. Did the parties consider special interrogatories to give to the jury? And if not, why not, or how did they decide not to do that? As you point out, it seems a little unusual to be having an appeal that assumes the jury decided this case on informed consent when it was submitted to the jury on the theories of informed consent and negligence.
It never came up, Your Honor. There were no big back and forth between counsel or the court about what we all sort of agreed that this was the appropriate way to ask. Since Your Honor raised that, though, I do want to mention there were two defendants below, Dr. Lewis and Dr. Boyle. Dr. Lewis is the doctor that ordered the medication first. Dr. Boyle picked up the patient the second day she was in the hospital and discharged her on the third day. We pled informed consent against both doctors. Dr. Lewis, in his discovery deposition, testified that he did not tell Mrs. Koch about the risks of this drug. And that was stipulated in the pretrial order. Now, he did sort of backtrack a bit at trial on that, and Mr. Elzafon mentioned that he wouldn't have left her in the dark. But it was a stipulated fact for the jury, and the jury knew this, that basically informed consent was not given. The risks and the alternatives were not offered. Now, Dr. Boyle, the second doctor that saw her on the second and third day, testified at trial differently. And Dr. Boyle said that his routine, and he would have done that in this case, would be to give informed consent. Dr. Boyle was found negligent. We submit that there was no evidence after Dr. Boyle.
How do we know he was found negligent as opposed to having been found not to have given the consent, the informed consent?
That's what I'm getting to, Your Honor. Dr. Boyle testified, it was my routine to go over all of the risks with my patients, and I would have done that in this case. My client is dead. I couldn't rebut that testimony. And I think that that tells us what the jury was doing. And the jury was thinking that because they found him negligent, they must have found him negligent for the underlying medical negligence claim, not the informed consent claim, because that claim, although it was never taken out of the case,
Tell me how they found him negligent. When we see cases that are appealed based on special interrogatories, they say something to the effect, do you find the defendant negligent? Do you find that the defendant's negligent proximately caused the injury? and, you know, and you keep going along. So tell me in the record, where would I find that the jury found that doctor negligent?
Oh, the jury verdict is in the appendix, Your Honor. I can get it for you. There are separate questions. My apologies. When you were asking about special verdict, I thought you were asking me, did they break it out for informed consent? No, there was a question, is Dr. Boyle negligent?
Right.
Is Dr. Lewis negligent?
Okay.
Do you want me to find that, Your Honor?
Nope, that's
No,
fine.
It's in the appendix.
That's fine.
Yeah.
Okay.
And are there separate questions regarding informed consent?
No.
Okay, so those two are combined.
Lumped in, because it's a subset of okay. medical negligence. And that's why I'm trying to quit about Dr. Boyle.
Getting back to what you were arguing, I gather the drift was that since there was uncontradicted testimony by Dr. Boyle that he would have made full disclosure and thereby obtained complete informed consent, the fact that he was found negligent means perforce that he was found guilty of substantive negligence or malpractice.
That's my point, Your Honor.
Let's test that.
Yes.
What, if anything, was argued to the jury about informed consent with respect to Dr. Boyle?
Your Honor, and this is set forth in our papers, all of the arguments in closing were directed to Dr. Lewis. My comments and defense counsel's comments were about Dr. Lewis. My reading of the record doesn't have any mention of Dr. Boyle for informed consent.
No mention of Dr. Boyle in closing?
No. No. I think at one point I did use the word defendants, but I think a fair reading of that would be that it's if you look at the closing as a whole, it's Dr. Lewis. But Dr. Boyle was never mentioned by name by either counsel in closing. And again, going back to my original point, it was sort of an add-on. And that is, if you're going to use this drug, which is very, very clearly contraindicated, all we're asking is that you tell the patient. And I think that's what all we're asking is that Dr. Lewis tell the patient before he starts the drug on Friday night.
So your argument was twofold. It was negligent to give this patient that medicine.
Correct.
Period.
Yes.
Alternatively, there was no informed consent.
Correct. There were issues raised by my opponent in his opening remarks about forcing doctors how to practice medicine. And our position would be that that's not what this court would be doing. Rather, this court would be deferring to the General Assembly, which presumably when the statute was enacted 30 years ago, took that into account. And the statute has many defenses. It has to be material. The risk has to be material. It has to be in light of a reasonable patient. It can't be emergency. And then there are actually three subparts of 6852 that set forth more exceptions, which are in there. So that certainly this court would not be telling the General Assembly how to practice. And our response would be the same to all of the policy arguments about doctors having to tell ad nauseum their patients things. Again, it's a reasonableness test, and it's a materiality test. Let me move on, if I may, to the causation issue. And to put this in context, when we're talking about the causation issue, or at least when my side's talking about the causation issue, I'm speaking about the pattern jury instruction that Judge Scott gave the jury. And specifically, what the defense was asking below was to add an additional prong, an additional causation prong. And what they asked for was, would the patient or Mrs. Koch, and they went back and forth below, but nevertheless, would the patient have decided differently if informed consent had been given? That's what they wanted. To begin with, that's not what the General Assembly put in the statute. The General Assembly very carefully set forth what the plaintiff must prove in 6852. But more importantly, included within what they put in 6852 are already two causation prongs. Number one, would a reasonable patient find the risk material? That's causation. Number two, did the treatment at issue cause injury? That's causation. And this very issue was raised in front of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. Pennsylvania has a statute. It's very similar to Delaware's. And in the Pennsylvania case, which is Grouse versus Cassell, and I cited it in my papers, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court said, and I quote, when the patient, after the patient is required to prove a causal relationship, I'm sorry, Your Honors, let me start over. They held that the causation requirement is met when the patient shows that he was not advised of the material risks, complications, or alternatives that a reasonable person would consider significant. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court said that's causation, and that's exactly what the Delaware statute, maybe a few different words, requires. And so that is causation. And to ask the plaintiff to show an additional prong, mainly that Mrs. Koch would have declined the treatment, number one, the position below was that Mrs. Koch, we had to show Mrs. Koch would have declined. And there were papers asking that our claim be dismissed because Mrs. Koch was dead. We can't prove the claim.
Well, just to make sure I understand your position, I gather it is that the statute, the causation requirement imposed by the statute basically contemplates a hypothetical reasonable patient. The use of the word material means that it would be likely to affect the decision, but there's no requirement to show that it actually would have did affect the decision or would affect the decision of that particular patient.
Correct. And I think the reason is this case. How could the plaintiffs prove this? That? We can't prove that Mrs. Koch would have decided differently if informed consent had been given. She's no longer with us. And I submit that that's...
Well, that may be, but if the legislature required that,
they certainly
it wouldn't
could.
Matter.
They certainly could.
So I gather that the thrust of your position is this is simply not a requirement in the statute, and the other side is trying to engraft it.
Absolutely. That is our position. Yes.
Are you trying to say, or did you argue in another way, we've said many times there can be more than one proximate cause of an injury. And part of the defense here was there were several other choices for why the patient might have died. Your argument was, well, including this medicine. And if she'd have been told about this medicine, that would not have been a choice. And then we would have known that she died from one of the other choices. But now that this medicine is in the mix, it was a proximate cause of her death or the proximate cause of her death, however you wanted to argue it.
Yes, Your Honor, and that was my next point, was the statute itself has reasonableness for a patient, materiality, that the treatment caused injury, and then the standard proximate causation question was given. Now, I do want to say, though, that there was an alternative medication, and it was amiodarone. And going back a moment, the reason why Solol is contraindicated in a patient without working kidneys is because the kidneys process the drug. And so you reach a toxic level of the Solol, which can cause sudden death, which is what happened in this case.
But, as you know, Mr. Elzevon said that at least the pharmacist thought it was possible in some circumstances. The treating physician in this case said he'd done it before, and there seemed to be a treatise to say that it was a possibility. So it wasn't unequivocal that no one ever did this under any circumstance.
The only testimony the jury heard below that this drug is used in dialysis patients was from Dr. Lewis. Dr. Boyle, the co-defendant, had never used this medication before on a dialysis patient. Dr. Rafel, who was from Columbia, well-credentialed, said, you don't do it. It's unwise. It's not recommended. The PDR has a black box warning that says do not use this in patients with creatinine clearance below 40, which is a dialysis patient. The American College of Cardiology says
don't
do it.
You're arguing the weight of the evidence, aren't you?
Well, I am, Your Honor. Yeah. Yeah, which obviously the jury was not satisfied of.
Can you enlighten us on the invited error issue? I mean, is that a position that you adhere to? Because the response from the other side appears to be, well, yes, we submitted this instruction and asked the judge to give it, but based on prior precedent, another malpractice case, the standard of review, even in those circumstances, is plain error.
Yeah, and the issue is, Your Honor, we could not find any cases where this court has looked at a non-pattern jury instruction drafted by the party who is now appealing that jury instruction. There are prior cases where a party accepted or consented to the pattern jury instruction having been given, but we could not find any cases where the party drafted a jury instruction, the part they wanted was given, and then that part was appealed. I think that would be the first time this court would allow that to occur. In addition, this was not on the radar below, this may versus shall. The Bellow case that you've heard about from Judge Babiarz, again, the same defense counsel was in that case. The same language was used almost a month after this case. It was May. So we submit that this was not an issue below, that an appeal was taken, and that this was added on as a legitimate issue, but that the invited error doctrine exists for a reason, and that our position is that it ought to be applied in this case.
It was invited not because it was submitted no objection made. It was invited because it was a non-pattern instruction that was specifically drafted by the party now attacking it. Is that the argument?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. But let me speak on that issue in the time that I have remaining, because it does make a difference. The statute arguably is mandatory, that the plaintiff has to show what is customarily given by other health care providers. And the pattern jury instruction says may consider, not shall consider. Now, in this case, it doesn't make a difference, because all the testimony, except for Dr. Lewis, who said he uses it in some of his dialysis patients, all the testimony was, I don't do it, or you don't do it. And so it's not possible in this case for the plaintiffs to have shown what's customarily given when the evidence was it's not supposed to be given. And so our response, if the court is going to look at the merits of this, would be that there's no plain error. There was one standard of care expert called at trial, Dr. Rafel. The defense didn't call any standard of care experts. Dr. Fortuin was their causation expert. He was deposed in discovery, and Dr. Fortuin even admitted in his discovery deposition, I have never used this drug in a dialysis patient. That's their causation expert. So the statute says to the extent something is customarily given, informed consent, the plaintiff has to show what that is. In this case, there's nothing to show. There's no custom. Compare this case to Barrio Canal. In Barrio Canal, the issue was, what is customarily given? That case involved a neurosurgeon who did a procedure for an aneurysm, and the question was, should the defendant neurosurgeon have told his patient, I haven't done this procedure in a while, you're going to do it on the Easter holiday, so the staff is going to be low, and you may want to transfer to a teaching hospital. And that was the dispute. Is that what is given customarily? In this case, there's no dispute. There's no custom. And I would just end with the defendants, when they testified about what they typically do, they said they would tell their patient about the risks. So that would, again, cover the what's customarily given.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
If I may tick off the responses, a lot of it's in our answering brief. The reference to Gauss is irrelevant because that's a battery case, and Judge Scott correctly said informed consent is not battery. There is mention of Dr. Boyle in the closing argument, in the transcript of my closing arguments, page 66, 69, and 88 at sequitur. He is mentioned. Mr. Lenke, I don't think he was trying to mislead. He just forgot. That's okay. We can't guess what a jury's thinking. As defense counsel, I don't usually like specific interrogatories. And in this particular case, there was separate as to Boyle, separate to Dr. Lewis as to negligence, but they are both lumped as to causation, which further complicates the matter. In Riggins, there's plenty of evidence in Riggins to uphold the jury verdict against a sole defendant, but because the jury instruction was ruled to be improper, the court said it's best in the interest of justice, and that Riggins case controls what to do with Dr. Boyle. I know I'm speaking quickly. The answering brief shows a lot of evidence on some of the points that Mr. Lenge raised. I specifically think it's important to note that on whether Sotalol is or is not applicable here, there was only one pharmacist. There was only one pharmacology expert testifying in that trial. The plaintiff called him, and the defense took from him, and I can cite the record, his agreement, it's okay to give Sotalol in this case. You have to properly monitor it. And that was a big issue, so everything was hotly contested. The Dr. Boyle slash informed consent argument, it must be respectfully pointed out that when he got onto the scene, the Sotalol treatment had already commenced. This was not informed consent to begin treatment. The treatment had already commenced. Justice Jacob wanted to know if there was any private cases involving the issues that we mentioned. The patent line of cases do get into that, which the court upheld without opinion, which cited the Largely case. And I see the red lights on, which means I have to stop.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you both. The court will take the matter under advisement and take a brief recess.